Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, finer things in life. You can reach us through WCTCAM.com, RestaurantGuysRadio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. I'm afraid we need to talk a little bit about politics now.
You and I talk about politics all the time, just not usually to our listeners.
Yeah, but, you know, this is, yeah, you're right. But, well, and we often disagree. Right? Well, you know, most people wouldn't realize that we often disagree. But I need to partisan politics at the moment. And, we have lots of friends who are Republicans, lots of friends who are Democrats. The first time I ever worked on it for a political campaign, it was Millicent Fenwick. She was a Republican. We're not, partisan. We're for good policy, especially where food is concerned. But I have to say, there are – well, first of all, we'll go into a nonpartisan criticism of corporate America that I can't believe. We know that Michelle Obama planted a vegetable garden, in the White House, which I think is a great symbolic gesture. And yes, everyone knows that Michelle Obama herself will not be out
there four hours a day. She's gonna pick three beets this year. But
it will do more good than the clearing brush that the last president used to do once in a while. And you know what? It sends a message, and that's what it was supposed to do. That's what the White House Victory Garden has always been designed to do. No first lady has ever gone out there since Martha and gotten on her hands and knees in the garden.
Hey, let's face it. A lot of what the president does is symbolic. Okay,
well,
that's part of the job of the president is to be a symbol for what we're all doing.
Well, so she planted the Victory Garden with the help of a local school, and she didn't use synthetic pesticides and fertilizers. Now, when the White House released the information on the garden, they didn't specifically note that it was an organic garden.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't make a point of that, but by the same token, they didn't use a lot of chemicals and pesticides. Well, the lobbying organization for the chemicals and pesticide industry has sent a letter of outrage to the White House.
Outrage that she didn't use chemicals and pesticides in her Victory Garden.
Because this, it would further the idea of this wacky idea that would,
that's going to ruin agriculture for everyone to come, for all time to come.
It's just the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. They claimed on the one hand that it would cause starvation and because it would discourage people from using fertilizers and
pesticides
would cause, and then it would also it's just the dumbest thing ever. Attacking the Obamas for that, I don't get it. And of course it should be an organic garden if they can do an organic. And sometimes those chemicals are necessary, but in the garden in the back of the White House.
Not. That's exactly right.
And in your lawn, in your garden, in your backyard, they may or may not be necessary. But you know, what the chemical companies have said here is they want them to use chemicals whether they need them or not.
Exactly.
Okay?
But that's what they've said throughout, to every farm. Use them whether you need them or not.
Because if you don't think you need them, you need them.
I mean, that is agribusiness today. Use chemicals whether you need them or not. And I think Francis and I are more centrist maybe than we appear on this. Francis and I are not against chemicals being available in the world to combat some type of blight or to combat some type of problem.
And used in moderation when necessary.
And used in moderation than necessary. I think even Francis and I, we would talk about, we're against using hormones in beef, but not necessarily antibiotics. If I don't want antibiotics produced to every cow all the time and be part of their feed, but if a cow gets sick, it doesn't bother me. You don't need to let the cow die. Give it some antibiotics. I think there's a reasonable place here somewhere in the middle where sensible people can say, you know what, this is a problem. I am having a problem with the boll weevil. Maybe I need some type of something to stop on this particular field to stop the boll weevils from attacking. I understand the logic there, but the basic, carpet bombing of our farms with chemicals
so that we can never get a boll weevil or anything else.
So that the earthworm can no longer live just doesn't make sense to me.
Boll weevil, huh? You picked the boll weevil.
I went back. I went way, way back.
That's the Nutley farmer in you is what that is. Up in the city. Anyway, all right. So that notwithstanding, we've beat that horse dead. Here's where it gets a little partisan. What I don't understand is the President of the United States last week or a couple of weeks back took his wife out to dinner in New York City and then went to Blue Hill Restaurant, mm-hmm. Which is a restaurant. I think they did it just because of the chemical companies had sent them such nasty letters about the pesticides in farms, because Blue Hill sourced its product from its own farm up north. It's a wonderful restaurant. We've had Dan Barber, the executive chef in the show.
And it's a great
owner of the show. It's a tremendous restaurant. And they are all about local, natural, sustainable.
It's an important restaurant, even more than it's a great restaurant. And that's what I'll say. It's an important restaurant because it really is a flag bearer for the whole movement of.
So there was some criticism of the president again because he went out to Blue Hill, and there was criticism of the president for going out to dinner when the nation is having a tough time. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? So you know what? Should all the restaurants shut down, or should the president never go out with his wife? Should he never have dinner with his kids? And then
you want to talk about costs? You want to talk about symbols? First of all, the symbol needs to be to get back out of our houses. Okay,
we need to go out to dinner, everybody. The economy will get better.
Right,
that's
exactly.
The president saying. Listen to him.
Okay, but the other thing is, does anybody really think that it costs the president less money to have parade of people that make his dinner at the White House make his dinner than it does for him to go out to dinner at Blue Hill?
Well, they say that anytime the president moves, it costs the taxpayers a lot of money because the bubble of security mm-hmm. around the president is intense. But that doesn't mean that the president, for any time the economy is bad, should stay hidden and holed up in the White House.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that you're allowed to criticize the president anytime he goes anywhere. You know, there has to be a certain...
Well, you're allowed to. You could just be wrong.
Yes, I'm sorry. Of course. But, you know, it makes me a little bit crazy because it removes – there are legitimate criticisms of this president and the last president and the president beforehand. But if you criticize a guy no matter what he does, then your criticism is invalid because whatever it is, you're going to complain about it. And, look, I remember that the president attended an environmental conference, and the big criticism from the corporate side and the Republican side, because it was a partisan issue, what – think of all the fuel he spent on Air Force One going to this mm-hmm. conference. Well, what do you suggest? Would he drive a Fiat? He's the president of the United States. If
Prius
he goes,
is what you wanted to say.
Whatever. But if the president of the United States, you know, he can't fly coach, he'd have to shut down the airport for him to get his ticket.
Right.
So it's a paper tiger argument, and I'm really sick of it. And I'm thrilled that the president of the United States went to Blue Hill Restaurant here in New York City. We've supported for a long time, and I think it sends just the right message, and I hope he and Michelle had a great time. And that's not about him being a Democrat or Republican or whatever.
It's about the president go out to a restaurant.
And let's hope this president goes out to a lot of restaurants and encourages the country to start going out to restaurants again. Because mm-hmm. you know what? You know what the largest retail employer in the United States of America is the hotel and restaurant sector. And you know what? We need people to go out to restaurants again. So anyway, that's how to get that off my chest. I'm okay now. You know.
Let's talk to Michael Ruhlman. That'll be more fun.
Yeah, all right. Well, we'll be back in just a moment with Michael Ruhlman. He's written so many interesting and wonderful books, and his new one will really help you in the kitchen. So stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, on stage left and Catherine Lombardi. And our guest today, returning to us, is Michael Rollman. He is one of our favorite and one of the most intelligent authors writing on food, wine, and many other things. He did The Making of a Chef. We talked about that on the show. The French Laundry Cookbook. And his new book is Ratio, The Simple Codes Behind the Craft of Everyday Cooking.
Hey, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be here, as always.
So this is a whole, you know, you write a whole lot of different kinds of books. Most authors don't write this many different kinds of books. Talk to us about Ratio.
Well, Ratio is sort of an anti-cookbook. It's asking people to understand the basic structure of our fundamental preparations so that we don't have to rely on recipes. To understand that cupcakes and pancakes and crepes and cakes are really all the same thing, just with different proportions of liquid. And if we know that, then we can cook with more control. When something goes wrong, we can figure out why. It just helps us to be more confident in the kitchen.
Well, one of the reasons that I think a book like this is necessary, and Francis and I have used this example a lot of times, you know, pasta and paste have exactly the same ingredients in them. It's all in how you put them together.
It comes down to ratio and technique, right?
And if you need one, you don't want to be making the other.
Well, you know, a lot of cookbooks, we always talk to cookbook authors, and we talk about how they'll describe a method or a technique, and they'll give you a recipe for how to do something. But hopefully if you go through the book and do a couple of those recipes, you'll then learn you'll get a feel for your food. But in mixing flour and water and fat and sugar, there's a real chemistry. You know, it's somewhere between a lot of the things you talk about here are between pastry and pastry, you know, and pastry is a certain amount of science to it. Would you agree?
So what's your question?
Well, it's not a question, really. I think just that when you talk about ratios, that it doesn't apply, obviously, to cooking a steak, but it applies to doughs, stocks, sauces, and it's, you know, there are some overall abiding rules that you sort of decoded. Were these rules sort of well-known by chefs, do you think, and articulated in this way, or did you think you had to decode?
Well, you're absolutely right. There's basic structure to all things. They can be broken down to, you know, base structures. And yes, chefs do know this and are taught this in schools. And, you know, some of these ratios are even, they're in indexes as 3-2-1 pie dough and 1-2-3 cookie dough. But no one has got them all down in one place and explored what they meant. And that's what I wanted to do with ratio. Often people do ratios with quantities, like so many egg yolks per pound of butter for a hollandaise sauce. Well, that's only good to a point. You have to account for the weight. Ratios are only really worthwhile when you do them by weight. And so I was concerned about that, about first making them useful as weights and then getting other people to be able to weigh them, because we're so afraid of scales and we're so afraid of math in this.
Well, you point to the kitchen scale as an extremely important device device in figuring out ratios, because, you know, if you're using a cup of flour, which is a measure of volume, and one egg, which is a menu per piece, and a pound of butter, which is a measure of weight, you really can't get ratios right if you're using three different methods of measuring.
That's right, especially when you consider the fact that flour can weigh between 4 ounces and 6 ounces for a cup, depending on how you measure, how human it might be, how long it's been sitting in the drawer. And if you think about it, that means that if you're making a cake or a loaf of bread that calls for 4 cups of flour, you can either have a pound of flour or a pound and a half of flour. Now, that's going to give you two completely different outcomes, whereas if you just weighed a pound of flour, it always come out the same.
So do you think my grandmother, who was pretty good with baking, do you think when she did stuff by sight, and, you know, she never quite measured anything, but the apple pie always came out perfectly, do you think it was that she just had a feel for the weight of that stuff, and sort of without knowing exactly what she was doing, that's how she knew was just enough?
She had a feel for it. She had an intuitive sense of it, and she just practiced a lot. She paid attention, and she learned from cooking.
Flour was never a year old in the pantry. She was making, you know, compacting on itself.
We'll call that bachelor flour. Having these ratios, I think some people may find it frustrating to not necessarily have a recipe, but a concept that you can apply to other recipes. But in your book, you also sort of supply recipes for each of these concepts to demonstrate them, right?
Of course, you know, I'm not really saying that we throw recipes out altogether. We need recipes. Recipes are valuable and are helpful, and sometimes I even use them. I'm not very good at following recipes, but recipes help us to, you know, recipes are great guides. Again, my point is that if you don't, you know, if you understand the ratio, then you're so much farther ahead when you're following a recipe. That if you only follow recipes, then you're sort of stuck. You're never going to be really cooking. You're never really going to improve, I don't think.
And not to mention the fact that every time I get to the Crisco section of the recipe, I always change it.
Yeah.
It's butter.
Without a doubt.
Michael, that's why
if I can't find any lard, I change it to butter.
That's why, bless you. That's why we get along, just that you said that. Now let's talk about the famous, pie dough, for example. You have, in doughs and batters, you have basically bread dough, pasta dough, pie dough, biscuit dough, cookie dough. Two things. One is, what tends to be the difference? How do we get from pie dough to cookie dough and biscuit dough and bread dough? What are the differences overall?
It's pretty much the amount of the proportion between flour and liquid. You know, bread dough has five parts flour and it's three parts liquid, whereas a pot of choux will have twice as much liquid as it does flour. And that's a really soft, it's almost a paste, it almost becomes like a batter.
Well, you know, some...
Also, there's egg thrown into some of these. So that's another variable. Pasta is three parts flour and two parts egg. Pot de choux includes egg, flour, water, and butter.
Well, and one of the things that you talk about in the book that's very helpful is also the different techniques for kneading these different doughs and how it differs. What I found fascinating was you explaining how it aligns the gluten network. Can you, that sounds very high tech. Can you talk to us about aligning our gluten networks properly?
Well, if we think of gluten as strands that can, I don't know, say imagine a ball with like 1-inch strands, and they're all out of they're just all piled up. That's kind of what bread flour. That is what happens when you mix flour and water together. By kneading dough, these strands of gluten, which are strands of proteins. They start to line up and become and adhere, which allows you, think about it, if you mix bread dough for just a second, just so it comes together, and try and stretch it, it doesn't stretch, it breaks. Whereas if you knead it for a while till it's soft and smooth, and you can start to stretch it, you can stretch it almost till it's translucent. That means the glutens are all aligned and you've made this dough elastic. And that's what you want when you're making bread. So the bread dough can contain the gas bubbles as the gas bubbles are growing.
Well, and I want to talk to you about a couple of that's fascinating. And I had read the book, so I knew that. I think one of the things interesting about this in all of your books is sort of they're sexy on the surface, but you sort of explain the underlying reasons behind things, and sort of a fascinating, sort of like reading the Sunday New York Times, you know, science the science section on Tuesday or the diagnosis section and the medical section on Sunday. I want you to weigh in though. We'll take a quick break and we'll come right back. And I want you to weigh in though on a couple of issues that vex home cooks, and one of them is the issue of lard versus pie crust, and I want to talk about thickening sauces as well, which is pretty fascinating. All right, so we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys, and we're talking with Michael Ruhlman about his new book, Ratio, The Simple Codes Behind the Craft of Everyday Cooking. It's a great book. If you want to pick it up, you can do so through our website at restaurantguysradio.com. And, you know, the material sounds kind of dry, but it's really a fascinating book. I think once you've read through this book, you will become a better cook. I wanted to ask you, first of all, about the wheel, the ratio wheel that is the cover of this book and that occurs again within the book. It's fascinating. Do you give these out as promotional little materials? I want one for my kitchen.
The designer at Scribner did that. I think it's a fascinating design in part, because it shows it not only gives the ratios for the does and bats, it shows how interconnected they are, and it's got sort of a mandala-like feel to it, a circle of life. It's an all-one-thing kind of design, which I think is really cool. They should make refrigerator magnets of these things.
That's exactly what I was thinking. It's fascinating. You should buy this. This book is worth it just for the cover, ladies and gentlemen. That's what I'm saying. But I'd like you to weigh in on a couple of issues. The sections that you deal with in your book, you deal with a few. One is does and, of course, does and batters. But you also deal with stocks and sauces and brines and mayonnaise and custards. But now, as far as does and batters are concerned, where do you weigh in on the – do we use butter or lard in our pie crust? And why?
Well, it depends on the effect you're having. I usually use butter because it's at hand, and it's delicious, and it's versatile. The thing is, the butter has a little water in it, whereas lard will not have water. You cook the water out of any water out of lard in its preparation, so it's going to be a greater shortening effect on the flour. Shortening, by the way, is it's shortening the gluten strands that we were talking about earlier. So you have to pay attention to little variations like that, but also you have to pay attention to flavor. Lard's going to have a little more porky flavor, which for a quiche might work great, but for a cookie, you might not want that porky flavor. My daughter does not like the porky flavor when I made a pie crust for her using lard.
An apple pie with that little bit of lard in it is just
I'm all over that.
Extraordinary.
I think it's what makes it. I mean, I think we've lost the appreciation of some of our great baked traditions by not using lard, by being afraid of lard.
Well, but this speaks to your book as well, which is you put the basics out for the fat, the water, the flour, and then, you know, you say, okay, well, go on from here, you know, young man, and experiment with using...
Go out and cook.
Exactly. And I think, but that's the glory of it. I'm, by the way, for the record, a half butter, half lard pie crust guy.
I think that's a great ratio, as it were.
Now my last question that I really want to throw out to you, there's a method of thickening sauces that I've always, except in pastry applications, viewed as a really cheap shot, and I don't care for it all. There are a lot of different ways to thicken stock. You talk about a roux, which is three parts flour and two parts fat, and we cook the flour in the butter fat. A bermain, which is one part flour, one part butter that you knead in there for gravies. And then you deal with the slurry, which is cornstarch and water. I despise sauces thickened with cornstarch. Why do I despise sauces with cornstarch? How is that fundamentally different than the others?
I think you despise them because they've been over-thickened with cornstarch. There's also Chinese restaurants will often thicken soups with corn, like hot and sour soups are sometimes thickened with a slurry, and it gives them a sort of unpleasant gelatinous quality that I really don't like.
Even in cheap restaurants, when I go and I get, you know, the Sunday buffet with my grandma, and you know the chicken gravy has been thickened with cornstarch and it congeal on my plate in just the most unpleasant fashion.
Okay, eat at my mother-in-law's house. You'll love a sauce flavored with cornstarch or thickened with cornstarch. It would be so much better than the jarred stuff.
If it's properly thickened, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference really between roux and cornstarch. I don't think there's a huge difference. I think people just have overused it or used too much of it or used too heavy of a hand. That said, I think they use roux, and roux's gotten a bad rap. I think roux is a fantastic way to thicken things, and it gives a richness and body to sauces and soups is really spectacular, and that we ought to use more roux more often.
Why don't you explain to our listeners how to make a good roux?
I would take, you know, quickly. I give a ratio just to give a benchmark.
Uh-huh.
Basically, you can take equal parts volume flour and butter because you're going to get more. You probably need a little bit more flour. So put a little bit of flour in a pan and some butter. In a pan, about a tablespoon for every flour for every cup of liquid you want to thicken, and enough butter to make it into a paste, and cook it for a little bit to get the starchy taste out, and that's all there is to it. You can cool it. You can make a batch to have in your fridge to just always throw it a little bit into it for instant thickening. It's a great little tool to have.
And how
we had somebody come on the show once who said that they like to toast their flour before they before they mix it into any sauces or anything like that.
I like that too. It gives it a nuttier quality, and you certainly do that when you're making a brown sauce. You're making a gumbo. You want brown flour. Now you can either brown your flour, toast your flour. You can just cook it in the butter. It's still going to cook. It's going to have less thickening power the more you cook it, though. So you have to pay attention to that as well.
How does roux work to thicken a sauce better than just throwing flour into a sauce work?
Well, if you just threw flour in, it could clump up and join together. When you make a roux, you basically coat all the little granules of flour with fat, and so they're all separated. And then once they're separated, they won't clump together. As they absorb water and heat, they expand, thicken, and that's where you get your thickening quality. That's what makes it thicken.
So Michael, I know you started this whole endeavor as kind of a writer who was wandering into the chef world and becoming a chef.
No, I'm not a chef. Chefs run kitchens. I am a writer and a cook, and sometimes I cook, you know, for professional reasons, and almost always I cook for family. So, but I'm not a chef, and I don't like to be called a chef. It makes me feel uncomfortable, because I think we sort of abuse the word chef in terms of chef, and everybody who cooks is a chef. But it's not true. There are cooks and there are chefs. Chefs lead kitchens. Chefs are leaders. Chefs are the head. A sous chef is the under chef. Chef de cuisine is the head of the kitchen. Chef means leader. Head of.
I couldn't agree with you
more.
Well
said.
And on that note, we'll recommend that everyone pick up this book. Mark and I have enjoyed it a great deal, and thanks for coming on our show.
Thanks, Michael.
Appreciate it. Good conversation, as always.
Pleasure to have you. The book is Ratio, The Simple Codes Behind the Craft of Everyday Cooking. The author is Michael Roman. You can find out more about it at Restaurant Guys Radio. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to us on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis at the Restaurant Guys.
What I loved about this book was it was simple. It was straightforward. It said, here, and it contextualizes, and Francis and I use the word contextualize a lot when we're talking about cookbooks, but what's the difference between and a pancake? What's the difference between a fritter and a popover? It is these ratios indeed. And I think that he did a great job with this book, did a great job making it very, very simple, very, very straightforward. You know, it's the simple codes behind the craft of everyday cooking. That's exactly what it is, the craft of everyday cooking. And, you know, most books don't cover those basics.
It's a keeper. The cover, this graphic they put to represent the ratios on the cover is striking.
It's perfect.
He didn't need to write the book. He should have just had that. There's technique in there. There are recipes in there. Anyway, well, I hope you've enjoyed this little three quarters of an hour with the Restaurant Guys. I know we certainly have. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.